From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It was a chilly English morning Tuesday when a group of publishing industry CEOs assembled at this year's London Book Fair. We weren't there, but judging from comments reported by Publishers Weekly, we think it might have sounded something like this. John Mitchinson, co-founder of Unbound, a reader-supported funding and publishing platform, quipped that publishers like to come here to parade their inadequacy, talk about how bad they're doing. Reading culture may be surging, he said, but the business is madness. Publishing, he said, is broken.
Bookstore sales have been sinking steadily since 2007, and though ebook sales are soaring by nearly 50% last year in the adult books category alone and 475% in the children's category, according to the American Association of Publishers, that still doesn't compensate for the loss. It seems ebooks are just taking a larger slice out of an ever-shrinking pie. According to one analysis, the average U.S. nonfiction book is now selling fewer than 250 copies per year and fewer than 3,000 copies over its lifetime. The complexity of the business, the razor-thin profit margins, the bookstore bankruptcies, combined with technological incursions and crazy competition, only contribute to the sense of tragedy of titanic proportions.
It's the end, boys. We've done our duty. We can go now.
Oh, and let's not forget another piece of bad news, at least for the Big Six publishers. This month, the Department of Justice filed suit against five of them for attempting to seize back control of book pricing from Amazon. That decision broke the back of their united effort to keep Amazon from undercutting them by selling books at impossibly low prices. More on that later.
Yes, it's time for our annual update on the state of the publishing industry. So let's begin with a survey of reading habits released this month by the Pew Research Center. It turns out that 41% of people who've owned a tablet or ebook reader for more than a year say they're reading more books than ever. But only 35% of those who own either device for 6 months or less say that. That could mean, according to Mike Shatskin, head of the Ideological Company, a publishing consulting firm, that people read more when they get a device. But it could also mean that the heaviest readers shifted to the digital formats first. If the recent converts are not so voracious, then don't look to ebooks to save the industry. Probably the weirdest finding is that 42% of ebook readers read those books not on Kindles, cell phones, or iPads. They read them on their computers. I asked Mike Shatskin, what's up with that?
Isn't that amazing? There's a lot of debate about what that means. There were a lot of people who said, yeah, I read on a computer because I'm reading professional stuff. I'm reading things in my office. But I also remember 5 years ago, when Harlequin started a short romance series, and the reason they told me they did it at the time was that so many of their books were sold to people who read them on their computers at work when they maybe should have been doing something else, that they wanted to have short stuff that could be read during a lunch hour.
Beyond the changes in the reading habits that the Pew study tracked, you've also written about changes in how publishers imagine their role.
The value that a publisher has brought historically, I summarize this way. We can put books on shelves. And for 100 years, that's been a great business. It is not going to be a great business for the next 10 years. It's going to get worse and worse. They're going to have to find some other value propositions.
Like what?
Well, I think that the main one is to be able to promote books better than authors can. You can't just publish any subject that comes along and let the bookstore sort out who the right customer is. You have to think about what areas you're going to publish in, and you have to publish in those areas over and over again so you know those communities and those communities know you. You add flexibility to sell them things that you might otherwise not have been able to sell them before that are related. So conferences, for example, or there's a publisher called Osprey, which does military. And you build up enough of a direct connection with people who are interested in military history, you can sell them battlefield tours, not just books. And that's the future. The future is siloed by interest.
What happens if you publish literary fiction?
If you publish literary fiction, then you're that's going to be the hardest kind of stuff to do.
You were about to say, then you're screwed.
I wasn't going to say you're screwed, but I would say this. In the 1830s and 1840s, the most popular American writers were poets. And the reason for that is literacy was low. People wanted to buy a book that a bunch of people could enjoy by somebody reading it out loud to them. By the 1880s, public education had solved that problem. And poets didn't do as well, and novelists did better. Now, one of the things that's been happening because of the ebook revolution is that genre fiction, romance, thriller, sci-fi, has done very well because there are a lot of people who read one or two or three romances or thrillers. They eat them like candy. The establishment can't keep their habit fed, so they're willing to try something different and new, particularly if it's cheap. The successful self-published writers have all been in genres. They haven't been literary fiction, and they haven't been writing biographies of Steve Jobs, for example. That book has got to cost $500,000 to write. You've got a serious journalist spending several years trying to do this with a research team. There's no way that a book like that gets written unless some publisher or somebody writes a check for $500,000 or $1 million.
If Walter Isaacson can't get paid what he needs to write the biography of Steve Jobs, a guaranteed bestseller, then the problem is that the public doesn't want it enough. Not that Amazon is driving down the prices of ebooks.
No, that's actually just not true, because you now have a market which is bifurcated, and you have lots and lots of books, most of the branded books that are between $10 and $15, and they yield revenue of X, which actually would support Walter Isaacson. And you have lots and lots and lots of books that are $1, $2, and $3, and some of those are selling a lot of copies. So what happens in this new economy that we're in is that the total amount of revenue generated by bestsellers drops precipitously. And Amazon doesn't care about that. If we lose major publishers, what we will lose is the books that won't even be written.
Mike, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Mike Schatzkin heads the Ideological Company, a publishing industry consulting firm.
For a literary fiction industry in freefall, one reliable source of good news is the announcement of the Pulitzer Prize. That's because the Pulitzer has developed a reputation for finding a balance between the critics' darlings and popular fiction, a sales sweet spot. That said, at least two of this year's three finalists were a bit unorthodox. One of them, The Pale King by David Foster Wallace, was an unfinished book assembled and published posthumously. The other, Train Dreams by Dennis Johnson, is a slim novella, much of which was published a decade ago in the Paris Review. Only the third, Swamplandia by Karen Russell, is a fairly traditional novel. Still, it took people by surprise when the Pulitzer winners were announced and the prize for fiction went to nobody. After all, it's been 35 years since the last time the Pulitzer Board declined to award the fiction prize. Author, Salon senior writer, and past Pulitzer judge Laura Miller says that it's a shame because no other award cuts through a balkanized literary world that can find precious little to agree on.
I'm a big fan of the Pulitzer Prize. I think that it is really helpful that a lot of people who aren't themselves writers or editors or critics have a prize that says to them, this novel, like last year's winner, is a great example, Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad. It has a somewhat unconventional structure, but yet you might really enjoy this. And people really did. So I think that's a great thing to have, a yearly reminder that literary fiction is not this completely impenetrable art form.
Tell me, please, about the process.
Well, there's a jury of three people. Usually it's a critic, an academic, and a novelist of some kind. And they read the vast majority of the submissions, which is just a total cattle call. I mean, anybody can send in their book with, I think it's $50, and really anybody does. And then they come up with three finalists. Ultimately, the board decides who the final winner is. The chances that they're going to be deeply read enough in contemporary fiction to pick an alternate if they don't like the three finalists is pretty much nil.
No, that's okay, because they do have that power to discard the recommendations of the poor schnooks who each read 300 books.
They do.
To choose one of their own liking, but they clearly didn't avail themselves of that option this time.
No, and they haven't for a while, though they did do it three times in the 70s, which will give you a sense of how contested the idea of literary quality was in that particular era.
So maybe the explanation really is just in the procedures of the Pulitzer Board, but is it possible that there's a larger explanation? You mentioned balkanization.
Yes. The reason why I use the term balkanization is because that is fragmentation plus acrimony. And so even when you have a book, as in The Year Before Last with Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, that a lot of people are saying, okay, this is the big unifying novel, there is actually a substantial fragment of the literary fiction reading world that automatically hates any novel that's declared the great American novel.
Does literary fiction as a genre recover from this? Is it getting close to being irrelevant?
Well, this is just one year, but I think we are coming out of a mid-20th century period where every educated person felt that it was expected of them to at least have read some of the most celebrated literary novels of the year. And people just don't feel that way anymore. And we could see this award as symptomatic of that.
Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Laura Miller is a former juror for the Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, Jane Austen, I like your books. It is so fun to read them. They teach me all about what it was like for a woman in 18th century England. Actually, I think it's 19th century.
This is On the Media.
Sometime or thereabouts.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Earlier, Bob mentioned the Justice Department's recent antitrust lawsuit charging Hachette, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, Macmillan & Penguin, and Apple with conspiring to fix prices on books. Actually, what they did was to conspire to wrest control of book pricing from Amazon. Amazon can afford to charge less than it pays for books to attract high-end customers to the site where they might buy other products. The publishers didn't want Amazon's super low price points to become the industry standard. They wanted to set the prices for the retailer. It's called agency pricing. And one prominent retailer, Apple, agreed. So Amazon scored a big victory last week when the Justice Department settled with three of the big six, who promised to cease conspiring with other publishers on agency pricing. Apple and two other publishers will proceed to court. Barry C. Lynn is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. He believes that while the Department of Justice has followed the letter of the law, it's missed its spirit.
They were discussing creating a pricing policy. That's very different than sort of creating a scheme to raise prices. And one of the things that people haven't focused on a lot here is that in the overall price of ebooks, between December of 2010 and 2011, went down by maybe 20%. What we want to protect here is a marketplace where you have many, many, many suppliers of books, writers of books, editors of books, and you want as much as possible to have no large powers in between the writer and the reader interfering with the marketplace.
But haven't there always been large powers standing between the reader and the marketplace in the form of large publishers?
We don't want to at any point say we're going to protect the big six publishers. What we would ideally want is to go back to what we had in the late 1970s, which is a system in which you had no dominant publishers and you had no dominant retailers.
Okay, so what happened in the 1970s and 80s. What was the situation before, and why did it change?
Going back to 1773, to the Tea Party, which was an action against the British East India Company, we used our anti-monopoly laws to distribute power so that no one had the ability to dictate to us as citizens. What happened in the late 1970s and 1980s is this really weird coalition of the consumerist far left and the libertarian far right came together and said, let's get rid of that old model. What we want to do now is make a system that yields more efficiencies so that it will benefit the consumer in the form of lower prices. So we took the very lessons that the United States was founded upon and that kept us free as a people for 200 years, and we threw it out.
The Justice Department was much more concerned about the collusion than about the pricing scheme. As a result, the biggest publisher using agency pricing, Random House, which was not involved in the actual conspiracy, according to DOJ, is free to go ahead and pursue agency pricing.
They are free to go ahead, technically. The problem is that unless everyone's doing it at the same time, no one's going to do it.
In the game Monopoly, one of the monopolies you can buy is a railroad. And you've likened what's going on in publishing to the railroad in days of yore.
In the 19th century, these new technologies, the railroad, the telegraph, allowed a few people to capture control over most industry in the United States. The new railroads, the internet, Amazon being probably right now commercially the foremost player. One of the ways that you neutralize railways is you prevented them from owning other lines of business, like quarries or oil wells. Because if you allow them to own other lines of business, they will favor their own lines of business. Right now, Amazon, we allow them to vertically integrate. We allow them to own publishing operations, to favor what they publish, and to disfavor what other people publish. Over time, this leads in one inexorable direction, which is towards complete control over this system by a single group of human beings.
Isn't it true that when Amazon underprices, it isn't cutting into the publisher's share? The publisher gets a certain amount regardless of how low Amazon sets the price for the book, right?
They get a certain amount, absolutely. The problem is 6 months from now, 12 months from now, if a reader was accustomed to spending $19.99 and then Amazon accustoms them to pay $9.99 or $8.99, even if the publishers this year are getting $12.99 at wholesale, next year they're going to get less because there's a new price in the marketplace and their share of that will be some fraction of the new price.
So what are you arguing here, that Amazon is going to kill the book industry with its low pricing? Why would it do that? That would be suicidal.
They actually don't really care that much about the book industry. Amazon wants to sell televisions. Amazon wants to sell shoes. They can lose money on books forever, throw them out the front door as a form of candy to lure us, the consumers, into their realm so that they know who we are, know what we like to buy, and then sell us all these other things forevermore.
So do you think in 40 years the Monopoly Board will have an Amazon Square?
Actually, we probably won't because most of the Monopoly games will be sold across Amazon, and I assume they won't allow that to happen.
Barry C. Lynn, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me today.
Barry C. Lynn is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. The publishing industry is not the first to be shaken by a newly digital world. It's also not the first to resist that change. For Matthew Ingram, a senior writer with the website GigaOM, the publisher's efforts to tame Amazon are only doomed to fail.
I think in some ways they are trying to play King Canute.
King Canute?
Yeah, King Canute was the one who tried to stop the tides. There's some debate about whether he was just an idiot or whether he was trying to show people that you couldn't do that.
You think that King Canute could apply to the publishing industry?
They are trying to halt something that can't be halted.
You know that overall book sales are falling. I'm not blaming Amazon for this, but there is a problem.
But are higher prices going to solve that problem? How is that going to help? I know these are just small examples, but if you look at self-publishers like J.A. Conrath, when he dropped the price to 99 cents, he sold 10 times, 20 times, 30 times more books. You know, Amanda Hawking, she's a self-publishing phenomenon. She made, I think, close to $2 million in under a year by self-publishing through the Kindle platform. By selling short books, not incredibly well-written books, 99 cents. How well-written does it need to be for 99 cents?
But haven't you sort of implicitly made the point that quality costs? What about the kinds of advances that publishers lay out to get authors that may be really good?
I'm not saying that publishers don't provide value. I think they do. But now, I think they need to show what that value is. A good editor and a relationship that a writer has with that editor is a hugely valuable thing, something that Amazon, at least so far, isn't providing. But that's no longer the default.
A lot of critics think that the Department of Justice has inadvertently strengthened Amazon's monopoly in its decision, which was intended to be anti-monopoly.
Amazon's monopoly has actually decreased from about 90% or so to, I think, the 60% range. Now, I know the publishers would like to argue that that's because of agency pricing. I think it's probably in spite of agency pricing. Ebooks haven't even existed for that long. Amazon effectively created that market and has, you know, the leading e-reader. So obviously it's going to have a huge market share. But I think over time that is going to decrease. It almost always does.
Talk to me about how digital rights management, DRM, figures into this whole argument.
Okay, sure. So digital rights management is anything that protects the content in some way, prevents you from moving it to another device, prevents you from copying it. There was a fantastic column, I think Charlie Strauss wrote it, the science fiction author, about DRM. And his argument was that by agreeing to restrictive DRM, whether it's Amazon's or Apple's, authors and publishers effectively gave Amazon a giant stick to beat them with.
I don't understand.
Well, DRM locks those books into Amazon's platform, right? You buy a Kindle, you buy your books through Amazon, you can only read them on your Kindle.
But you have to have one format or another.
Sure, but you should have as many different formats as possible. So, in fact, there is a publisher who is pretty much doing that. O'Reilly has no DRM on any of its books. And Tim O'Reilly has said that, you know, piracy is this huge boogeyman that everybody talks about. Our books are going to be pirated. In some cases, you actually want your books to be pirated. It's how people find your content. Paul Coelho, the Brazilian author, pirated his own books, uploaded them to BitTorrent servers so that he could broaden his reach into new markets. Never told his publisher. But of course, you know, now he has 3 million readers in Russia, and his publisher thinks that's fantastic.
So if you were talking to the big six publishers now, what would you advise them to do?
I would say reduce your costs.
Fire your editors?
Not necessarily. God knows there's got to be some fat in the publishing business.
What else?
Get rid of DRM.
Would you advise them to just sit back, think of England while Amazon sets the prices?
No, of course not. I mean, they have to negotiate with Amazon.
But Amazon holds all the cards.
Amazon doesn't hold all the cards. Amazon doesn't have all the content. It wants that content so that it can offer it to people on its platform. Push Amazon to give up on DRM. They want it just as badly as the publishers did. Instead of trying to protect a specific price point, think about what your business is going to look like in 5 years or 10 years, and how can you get there?
Matthew, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Matthew Ingram is a senior writer at the technology website GigaOM. Now, publishing consultant Mike Schatzkin, you heard him about 20 minutes ago, offers us a tale about an author so wise and so powerful that she somehow retained the digital rights for her books, standing up to Amazon. J.K. Rowling dubbed it Pottermore.
What she did was she said, we are perfectly happy to sell our ebooks without any digital locks. But what we will do is watermark it. So if that copy ends up on a pirate site, we're going to know it was your copy that ended up there. It's called social digital rights management, or social DRM, which is to say, I'm going to threaten you with shame or maybe litigation, but I'm going to know it was your copy that went to a pirate site. By doing that, unless Amazon played ball with Pottermore. Pottermore would just sell Kindle-compatible ebooks off their own site, which is essentially what they're doing. And what it forced Amazon to do is to turn the Potter customers over to Pottermore so that Pottermore gets to register them and know who they are.
So what did Amazon give up in this equation?
The monopoly on the customer information. As a matter of fact, I don't know what information Amazon gets about the customer. That's a negotiation between Pottermore and Amazon. But the customer, rather than buying from Amazon, buys from Pottermore. And as a result, Pottermore captures all the data on that customer and the ability to solicit them for other things in the future. It's a very, very powerful change.
So there's the valuable commodity of customer information. And also, doesn't J.K. Rowling get to set the price?
Yes.
Okay, so why don't other publishers go this route?
If a medium-sized publisher said, we're going to do what Pottermore's done, I think Amazon would just take their books off the site rather than collaborate with them. But Amazon couldn't be put in a position where a Harry Potter book was out and you couldn't find it on their website. They just couldn't do that without hurting themselves more than they hurt anybody else. So they're not doing that. If the big publishers went to a Pottermore solution, I think we'd see a very, very interesting battle in the industry.
Mike Schatzkin, head of the Idealogical Company.
This book is so awesome. I can do anything. This book is so awesome. I am the potions king. Did you hear that, Half-Blood Prince? I said I was the king. Can you hear me, Professor Snape? I can make anything. This book is so awesome.
We should point out at this point that On the Media made many requests for Amazon to appear on this week's show, but Amazon made nobody available. Most publishers fear running afoul of Amazon, even big publishers. But there's one very small publisher that seems to be fearless. Randall White of the Educational Development Corporation recently pulled all of his company's books from Amazon in protest of the company's business tactics. Educational Development publishes educational books for children. Its biggest seller is a reassuring message to self-conscious youngsters.
The title sold the most is Everyone Poops, sold over a million copies. But we do have great books, educational, science, history, nature, and foreign language, but Everyone Poops is our number one seller.
You sell through bookstores, but you have a big direct sales component, kind of like Tupperware parties. Tell me about it.
We have around 7,000 ladies who sell books through the direct selling method. They can do fundraisers in schools, book fairs, home parties. So these are independent consultants working out of their house. It's a very powerful sales force, though. And what's happening now with so many smartphones, they'll make their sales presentation, and among oohs and ahs on how wonderful the product is, pop out that smartphone and go, well, I can get that cheaper on Amazon. Well, there's a basic rule of sales, and that is whoever makes a sale has to get paid or they quit. It really came down to one individual lady. She went into a school who had never seen our products before, presented them to them, and the school went, wow, I like these. And the next day she went back in to pick up the order, and they'd bought it from Amazon. And so that day I just decided I've got to do something better.
So is it easy to get out of the Amazon ecosystem?
We didn't sell directly to Amazon. We sold through a large distributor, Baker & Taylor. So I was in touch with Baker & Taylor and told them, really, they're killing my business. But they were such a big part of Baker & Taylor that they said, well, too bad. So I had to terminate the entire Baker & Taylor account, which is substantial for us.
And a very expensive decision for you, at least at first blush. How has it worked out?
An article was written about us in the New York Times. I have been overwhelmed with the response just because of that article from individuals, stores, other publishing companies, other people in industries, not even ours, music industry, that have called me and said, congratulations, that took some big ones. A guy called me who was vice president of a regional chain with 65 stores and said, thanks for standing up for retail stores. As it turns out, we've been trying to get in his chain. And that day, we opened the account. So I can't tell you how heartwarming it is for the public to support us in this decision.
But I have to ask you whether what you've done indicates that David can defeat Goliath, or whether it indicates that what you're really protecting is a business model that just doesn't work in an internet world.
There is a company that we are very familiar with that started 7 years ago, and they sell only in the direct selling method. And in 7 years, they've built 500 million annual sales. That doesn't sound like a dead channel to me. The problem is you can't have a woman sell to her friends and the next day find it cheaper someplace else because they think their friend has cheated them.
What's going to happen?
Well, I believe our 7,000 ladies are going to be so happy now that I've untied one hand behind her back that they're going to talk a friend into joining them, and we're going to have 14,000 people selling books, and our sales are going to double. That's what can happen if you get it right.
All right, man. Well, thank you very, very much.
Okay. Thanks.
Randall White is the chief executive of the Educational Publishing Company.
Coming up, how serendipity saved Moby Dick.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help doctors, lawyers, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, working to help small businesses turn fans into customers with social campaigns. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Buying a cheap knockoff is not just a problem with watches and handbags. Increasingly, knockoff books are being made. If you go onto Amazon's website, for example, to purchase Stieg Larsson's best-selling The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, you might stumble upon I Am the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, a completely unrelated book self-published on Amazon through its Create Space imprint. Fortune senior editor Stephen Gandell looked into the knockoffs on Amazon and found a number of the books that he says were clearly meant to confuse people by trading off of more popular titles.
There was Steve Jobs by Isaac Worthington, which sounds a lot like the book that's very popular now, Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson. There was also 35 Shades of Grey by J.D. Light, which sounds a lot like 50 Shades of Grey, also by a two-initial author, E.L. James. There's a very well-selling book by a Nobel Prize-winning economist called Thinking Fast and Slow. Amazon, until recently, was selling a book called Fast and Slow Thinking. There's What to Expect When You're Expecting. And if you buy this book, you probably won't get the book you're expecting because it's not the very popular book.
But that's an actual title.
It's a book by someone else by the exact same title.
So if you get suckered into buying 35 Shades of Grey by J.D. Light, who in all probability doesn't exist, what do you get?
You get a book that's more like a pamphlet. It's not nearly as long as the real book. And most of these books that are knockoff books are printed in a very weird format. They're usually very large type, like Steve Jobs by Isaac Worthington, not the right book. It had about 40 words per page. There were huge words on each page, about 2 words per line. And it looked like the material was rewritten from the Wikipedia page. It followed the kind of outline of what's on the Wikipedia page. The reviewer for that book said, do not buy this book. This is a pamphlet. It looks like something that would be handed to you on a street corner.
You spoke to the author of I Am the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, not the late Stieg Larsson, but a woman named Karen Peebles, who claims to have written 10,000 books and published them through Amazon's Create Space.
She said she was a stay-at-home mom who homeschools her children, and this was a good way for her to get nice royalty checks with not having to leave the house. But I said to her, you know, there's this other very popular book that is called The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And she said that when she wrote her book, she hadn't heard of it. But she wrote her book in 2008, well after the book was already internationally famous. And she chose not to publish it through Amazon until mid-2010, well-timed for the popularity of the book in the U.S. It seems less than coincidental.
Let's talk about the system that allows this scam to take place. The titles were published through this Amazon CreateSpace software. How is it that Amazon cannot filter out obvious, non-serious publishing content?
The comeback Amazon would have and say, well, we're not really the publisher. We're just distributing these self-publishing books. They don't have a real publishing relationship in the way the book industry thinks about them. Amazon doesn't acquire the rights to the books. They don't edit them. But to the average consumer, there's no way to know. When you go on the website, CreateSpace, Amazon's division is listed as the publisher. It should say the person's name there for the publisher if it's really a self-published book. But it doesn't. It has this CreateSpace label that makes you think, oh, I'm getting a real book, when what you're getting is not.
Has anyone committed a crime?
Titles of books are not copyrighted. So there's a gray line here. And there is a book titled The Dragon with the Girl Tattoo. You're able to sell that. I mean, clearly that's a parody and a new kind of work. When you're just trying to trick the consumer into buying your book because they think it's that other book, then that's illegal.
You know what, Steve? You should write a book about this very thing, and I know exactly what you should call it.
Lay it on me.
Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone.
I'm on it.
Stephen, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Stephen Gandell is the senior editor for Fortune magazine. Let's say you've just written the great American novel, as I recently did. Assuming you publish it this year, as I plan to, and then you tragically expire, as I don't plan to, your masterpiece will still be protected from copyright infringement until 2082. Today, the 14-year term our founding fathers originally established has been extended to the author's lifetime plus 70 years. Why? Because in 1998, lobbyists for some beloved vermin convinced Congress to, yet again, extend the copyright term.
Oh, hello, Minnie. Mickey Mouse, you're late for our date.
Paul Heald, a professor of law at the University of Illinois, has evidence that the long copyright term brought about by Mickey and Minnie silences a whole lot of other voices. Heald looked at 2,500 newly printed fiction books selected at random from Amazon's warehouses and found that while there are a great number of books available that were published prior to 1923 and are now in the public domain, 1998's copyright extension resulted in a sharp drop in availability for books published after 1923. In fact, going back to most of the 20th century, surprisingly few titles are available.
Only 25 of those 2,500 books were published during the decade of the 1950s. 75 of those books were actually published during the decade of the 1850s. There's about 4.5 times more books actually published in the 1950s than there were in the 1850s. But it holds in general that these older works are significantly more available and that we have as many books from 1900 to 1910, new editions of them available on Amazon as you do books from the year 2000 to the year 2010.
It's very easy to see why Disney doesn't want Mickey Mouse in the public domain because it's still ringing the cash register. But how do we quantify what is lost when material doesn't go into the public domain?
Well, that's a good question. As far as the cost issue goes, my wife's a choir director, and she sees it quite starkly in the prices of sheet music that she has to buy for the choir. So if it's a public domain piece, she can photocopy at about, you know, 3 or 4 cents a page, and it's more like 50 cents to a dollar a page if she's having to buy the sheet music. So I mean, you can sometimes put a dollar figure, and it's very hard to put a dollar figure on, for example, situations like the famous PBS documentary Eyes on the Prize, which came out in the early 90s, I think the most highly regarded documentary of the civil rights era. It's very expensive to make a documentary, right? You have to get all sorts of rights in photographs and film footage, and especially in this case, music, because, you know, there really is a soundtrack that we recognize that sort of goes with the civil rights movement. And it was very expensive for them to get any sort of long-lasting rights to the music. That caused the documentary basically to disappear. PBS couldn't show it on TV because there were no licenses. And this tremendously important work essentially was lost due to the fact that the copyright owners were unwilling to license the background music at a reasonable cost.
When Disney and other copyright holders were lobbying the Congress for the extension of the copyright protections that they enjoyed, they brought with them a fairly long list of really frightening sounding consequences if copyright should fall precipitously into the public domain. Can you tell me what can go wrong when rights holders lose those rights prematurely?
Economists siding with the publishing industry came up with a number of arguments, one of which is that works would be tarnished and debased by inappropriate uses, and the examples almost always involve pornography. What would happen if we had a Superman porn movie or a Mickey Mouse porn movie? The second is that works might be overused, not that they would be used inappropriately, but just used too much. The song would be played too much in the background of advertising. We'd become sick of the song and no longer want to consume it. It would be worn out. The third argument, and the one that Congress seemed most interested in and found most plausible, is really quite exactly the opposite, and that is that without owners, works, in fact, would be less available, and that we should continue to extend copyright terms to ensure that there are owners out there to make sure that the public continues to encounter and see these works.
But the Amazon research that we were discussing earlier seems to tell an exactly opposite story, that being in the public domain actually increases the shelf life of literary work.
Right, at least as far as fiction works goes, this is what we're going to continue to find.
One of the great arguments against excessive extension of property rights is innovation will be suppressed if the status quo is afforded too much economic protection. Does that argument apply to literature?
One example of this, I've got a nice grant from Google to study the market for audiobooks. So one very simple thing we looked at was the most popular 20 books from 1913 to 22, all in the public domain. Not surprising, there's audiobook versions for all of them. If you look at the most popular 20 books from 1923 to 1932, all protected by copyright, only 16 of them have audiobook versions. So the ability to sort of make just a derivative work like an audiobook from an existing work seems clearly to be stifled by the length of copyright that we currently have in force.
The internet has obviously changed a lot of thinking about intellectual property. Would you care to make a prediction as to what Congress will do next to try to reckon more with current digital reality?
This current extension expires in 2018, so the lobbying will start up pretty soon to extend another 20 years. Now, there was no empirical research available to Congress in 1998. There is now. Whether that makes a difference or not, I don't know. Congress doesn't seem to care as much about academic research in this area as other countries. For example, England recently came out with what's called the Hargreaves Report, which basically says that the UK is not going to do any more tinkering with the Copyright Act in the absence of empirical research. American copyright owners failed to convince the Japanese Diet to extend copyright protection 20 years there because they weren't able to provide any sort of hard numbers suggesting that this would be a good thing for the Japanese people. So maybe Congress will take a cue from other legislatures around the world.
Yeah, of course they will. Congress cares deeply about scholarship and empirical evidence.
Sigh.
Well, Paul, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great.
Paul Heald is a professor of law at the University of Illinois and professorial fellow at the Center for Intellectual Property Policy and Management at Bournemouth University.
We've just heard about how the vagaries of intellectual property can influence the fate of books, old and new. But obviously, humans are also instruments of literary destiny. As a newly minted editorial assistant at Norton, writer Tom Bissell was able to resuscitate an out-of-print novel called Desperate Characters by Paula Fox. Bissell convinced Norton to republish Fox's book, reviving her career. In his new book, Magic Hours, Bissell writes that the experience shook his faith in books. Tom, welcome back to the show.
It's always great to be here with you.
The faith that I'm talking about was your belief in the power of great art to rise above, quote, base commerce and sheer indifference and live.
What shook my faith was the idea that suddenly I was somehow the most important part of this process. And I think processes seem much more reassuring when you're not part of them.
And your experience showed how random events can rule the destinies of the greatest works of art. You cite the novels of Kafka.
Kafka asked for all of his work to be burned. One of the two people he told to burn his work did it. The other did not. Now, if Max Brod, the guy who did not burn Kafka's work, had, as I put it, loved him enough to take his plea to him seriously, you know, we would have lost one of the most emblematic writers of the 20th century. In the case of Paula Fox, this was a writer who was completely out of print. I was an editorial assistant at a house that was not known for encouraging its editorial assistants to propose reprints of out-of-print novels. And yet on the day that I brought the book up, I remember everyone was in a kind of a good mood. Everyone just seemed sort of happy that meeting.
It could have been the barometer or a particularly tasty lunch or your personality.
It could have been any one of those things. And the fact that the book took off, launching Paula back into literary consciousness, she's really recognized as one of the most significant post-war writers. All these chance events that led up to my even knowing of that book, and then that gave me the strange confidence to propose this to my colleagues, it freaked me out a little bit. It made me realize how fragile these processes are.
And is that why, in your essay, you traced the tenuous fates of three writers that we might never have heard of or certainly not remembered: Walt Whitman, Herman Melville, and Emily Dickinson?
Now, of the three, Walt Whitman's survival was the least surprising, because he was always a pretty famous writer, but I think amongst the literary tastemakers of his day, he was regarded as a bit of a joke. And he certainly wrote a lot of poems that encouraged them in that thinking. And he was such a shameless self-promoter that I think people kind of got really sick of him. So in Whitman's case, I think it was when all the people who knew him personally were dead, that, you know, that allowed people who didn't remember what a self-promoting ass he could be from time to time, that they were able to go back to his work and rediscover it.
And what about Herman Melville?
Melville is the one that I think should keep novelists up at night. Who, you know, he had two very early successes, which were published as nonfiction, but in fact were very heavily fictionalized accounts of his life in Fiji. And they were very successful, and he sort of set himself to change the game. And he wrote this massive, incredibly weird, ambitious novel, unlike any novel anyone had ever written before, Moby Dick. And it was a resounding unsuccess. It sold 3,000 copies over its 36 years in print.
And so how did he come roaring back and become enshrined in the canon?
The one Melville resuscitation attempt that stuck was Carl Van Doren, a very influential American critic. And he, according to the legend, found a copy of Moby Dick in a used bookstore, went home, read it, was so blown away that this book had like completely vanished from literary consciousness, and he wrote an essay about it. D.H. Lawrence noticed that essay, Ian Forster noticed that essay, and then in the teens and the 20s, Moby Dick actually re-entered American consciousness, and all of his books were brought back into print, in which they have stubbornly stuck since then.
So you suspect that if it hadn't been for this used bookstore and random chance, that just wouldn't have happened.
It's a very good argument for used bookstores, isn't it?
Emily Dickinson, she relied basically, posthumously, on her sister.
Her sister was the one person that seemed to understand what she was up to. And the woman who wound up editing Emily Dickinson's poems never met her face to face. And Emily Dickinson would write poems up in the attic while this woman would play the piano downstairs, and they would leave gifts for each other at the top and bottom of the stairs, but they never actually met. And when Emily Dickinson died, this woman, Mabel Todd, just out of sheer devotion, and Lavinia Dickinson, Emily Dickinson's sister, pressured every New England literary figure they could think of to put these poems out there. And just like Melville, she was doing something so utterly new that people just were unable aesthetically to recognize that this was great. Houghton Mifflin had the poem sent to them, the great Boston publisher, and they were returned as too queer to publish. When the poems finally were published, the public instantly recognized that this was something spectacular.
And perhaps one of the greatest lessons of your essay is that these chaotic forces that determine the fate of an artistic work have always been with us. And you cite Aristophanes, who lost a contest but won immortality.
Yes. Aristophanes, The Clouds, placed third to two other plays in this dramatic contest. However, the two plays that we know were judged to be, quote, better than Aristophanes' play, they were like dust in the wind. We have no idea what happened to them. They don't exist anymore. And it's just sheer chance that any of Aristophanes' plays survived. I mean, most of them didn't. The ones we have no idea if they're his stinkers.
The good stuff doesn't always rise to the top.
No, and I'd like to imagine an alien civilization who has only, say, The Firm, Sidney Sheldon's collected works, and the Book of Mormon to determine what we were like today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Tom Bissell's new book is called Magic Hours.
At home. sitting in my favorite nook. A girl's trying to get me eat some dinner she cooked. I'm reading a book, girl, I'm reading a book. Don't you ever interrupt me while I'm reading a book.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, BJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Louisa Beck and Rob Schoon, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.